Well, good day and welcome to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and it's great to have everybody joining us again this week. We have a fantastic show for you here. Some serious news things that we're going to cover. We're going to be talking about some recent fires in the eastern part of the United States. We're usually talking about wildfires on the West Coast, but this time it's dealing with fires on the eastern half of the United States, and we'll talk about that a little bit. But before we get into the rest of the show, I want to go ahead and bring in my co-host, freezing a little bit in Colorado. Hi, Sam.
Oh, my God, Jamie. Yeah, I wasn't here this time last year, so I didn't realize how cold it gets in Colorado. And next week, we're getting a colder chill. It's supposed to be like 25 during the day and 1 degree at night. I don't think in my entire life I've dealt with 1 degree, so that should be pretty interesting. Needless to say, I'm staying in the house. How are things out there on the East Coast?
They're good, but speaking of cold weather, I've got a friend of mine who's in Fairbanks, Alaska, and he's been posting on Facebook regular weather photographs of his weather station, and it's been like, you know, -4 during the middle of the day. You know, that's the warm and the warm temperature he's got, and pictures of how he has to put boots on his dog and wrap him up before he can take the dog outside. So, and the dog hides because it doesn't want to go out in the cold weather.
He's smarter than most of us. Yeah, I'll have to check that out. That sounds interesting. And it's interesting that we're not too far off from Alaska right now. So, Joe, you just got back from New Zealand. I don't know what the weather likes there, but, you know, you're here with us. You're in the middle. You can tell us a little bit about what you and Jim are doing. You're both here doing some training, doing some night training. What's that all about?
Well, that's true. Hi, Sam. Hi, Jamie. Jim and I are here together. We're in the outskirts of Arkansas someplace tonight, doing a extended care training scenario with some Air Force parajumpers that'll last most of the night tonight. Doing our usual Paragon thing, this time with the special operations guys. So it's cold down here, but not quite as cold as where you are.
Well, that's good to know. You know, you're used to a lot warmer temperatures, so we wouldn't want to chill you out. But we're glad you made it back from New Zealand. We're going to talk about that in just a minute. I just wanted to say hi to someone new. We're going to talk with a little bit more in depth later. He's been a listener since the beginning, and I found him rather by accident. And his name's Kyle Nesson. He's another Coloradan. And we have, you know, we've been chatting and found out we had a lot in common in terms of ski patrol and different things that we do. And he's a meteorologist, so we can definitely tap into his expertise on these subjects. So, hi, Kyle.
Hey, Sam, and hello to everyone out there listening on the podcast. Thanks so much for inviting me on the show. Like you say, I'm a huge fan, been a loyal listener for a while. And it's always fun to make those connections from a random like or a reply on Twitter. So really happy we were able to connect.
Me too, because we definitely got some subjects to talk about with you. So, Jamie, what's going on in the news this week?
Well, I mean, we have an earthquake that popped up in the news most recently a few hours ago in Peru. Magnitude 6.3 earthquake. And that kind of brings us around to talking to Joe again, because the funny thing was that we no sooner bid Joe adieu and knew he was flying to New Zealand than we saw that there was an earthquake in New Zealand. And Joe, I know it was serious news down there. There was some loss of life and people cut off because main roads were destroyed. What did you learn about that while you were down there?
Well, so first of all, that was not my fault. I just want to be clear about
sure?
that. Yeah, it was actually quite an experience.
See,
you know,
this is a gem. Never travel with Joseph.
Oh, that's a good point. I have the worst travel luck, and that just goes right along with it, I guess. But it was quite the experience. We landed in Auckland and turned our phones on, and, of course, they immediately lit up with multiple messages and, you know, our initial thing was, oh, that was so nice. Everybody really misses us. That's great. And then we found out they just wanted to make sure we were okay from the earthquake. So it turned out in Auckland, which is very north on the northernmost island of New Zealand, that it was really kind of a non-issue there. They felt it a little bit, but no damage and really no disruption in daily activities. Most of the quake was felt mostly on the South Island between Christchurch, which was hit pretty hard about 5 years ago, and the capital of New Zealand, which is on the northernmost point of the southern island. That fault line sort of runs through that island and then goes out to sea. So the damage there on the South Island was thankfully mostly in rural areas, and did some pretty significant landslides onto some coastal highways, which cut them off completely. I think they had a highway tunnel collapse. Railroads were affected pretty severely. Just the land shift was pretty impressive, several feet in some cases, where one area slipped below another. And that was pretty impressive to see. But I think the biggest issue had to do with the fact that it's a very heavily touristed area, and it was a real challenge to get those tourists out of New Zealand. So the trip and the earthquake happened to coincide with what I think is the 250th birthday of the New Zealand Navy. And so they were having a big celebration there, and there were ships from navies from all over the world that were sailing into Auckland as part of their celebration. And many of those ships just went on to the South Island and loaded up on passengers and tourists, et cetera, and transported them to other locations so that they could, get home, basically. So once again, as it seems to be not terribly uncommon with a disaster, it was quite coincidental to other things happening that made the response better and made it flow quite easily. So. Other than that, an absolutely beautiful country and a wonderful place to visit. Highly recommended. Just getting there and getting back is tough.
Especially for you.
Especially for me. My luggage went through Sweden or North Korea or somewhere, so, as it always does.
But Bilbo Baggins is safe.
Yeah, he's smart enough to carry some things with him that he knows he's really going to need, because they won't end up where
that is true. Well, I can honestly say that I sent a text to FEMA headquarters shortly after I arrived, just to let them know that I was in country and if there was something I could do to let me know. And, that I was already here, and they did respond, thanks, so far no significant requests, and, we'll let you know. But they had it well in hand, and they were more than prepared for it.
Yeah, the federal assets have been doing a lot of international travel, so one never knows, although I would expect New Zealand to be pretty well prepared for this kind of thing. But how lucky, I did not know about the ships, how fortunate that turned out to be that they were right there and willing to help. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, it was very cool, and actually quite an amazing sight to see all these naval vessels from all over the world in the same place. So it was quite the spectacle, and turned out to be quite an effort on all countries' parts to help out.
That's awesome. Any questions on that, Jamie, for Joe?
No, just glad to have you back safe and sound, and glad that that the earthquake didn't affect you and enabled you to have a good trip with your wife and enjoy yourselves. I understand you guys found some really amazing ice cream while you were down there.
Yes, we did. So interestingly enough, of course, it's very volcanic soil down there, and it is a very green country, much like Ireland. So things grow quite well, and apparently the cattle that feed on that grass produce a very creamy milk, which makes for amazing ice cream. So if you want really awesome ice cream, New Zealand is the place to go.
It's worth the trip, huh? Well, you'll find
it's
that
worth
in
the trip.
You'll find that in the UK too. I know you got a trip planned there, as I did in Scotland, because we the same green exists there and the same happy cows, I assume. So bring it in.
It looks very much like that.
Let's bring it in a little closer to home. Of course, while you were gone, Tennessee had quite a few things going on, from a major bus crash to, of course, the Gatlinburg fires. And as I was reading up on that, they were called by some people apocalyptic. And I was just reading, and these were early statistics, so I'm sure they got worse than what they were here. But this showed early on that 7 people died, 700 homes and businesses were damaged, including 300 buildings within Gatlinburg, which, of course, is a very historic city. It displaced more than 14,000 residents, consumed more than 15,000 acres. The Gatlinburg Convention Center was barricaded. They lost the Mystery Mansion and the famous Cupid's Chapel. And we'll talk to Kyle a little bit later about the 90-mile-an-hour winds that stoked it. So you've been having some communication, Joe, with Gatlinburg. So what's going on from your end?
Well, so that's true. The the State Emergency Management Agency has been pretty heavily involved there, sending additional resources from around the state in there. The Gatlinburg Fire Department is actually quite small and a volunteer service. And I think many of those firefighters have lost their homes as well in the fire. So it's been quite a challenge for them. Jim and I actually were on the phone with the fire chief up there just in the last half hour, talking with him. And I'll let Jim touch on that just a little bit.
This is Jim. So Greg Miller is a fire chief there. He's a dear friend of both Dr. Hawley and mine. And so I've been trying to get a hold of Greg. Of course, he's been extremely busy for the last, several days. But he's done, and if you've watched the news, if you guys are getting it, he's done an amazing job handling the press and handling his resources. So Gatlinburg Fire Department is a paid and volunteer department. I think they have 2 stations. One of them, I know for certain, one of them burned down, one of their newer stations. Mm-hmm. But so for those of you that don't know what Gatlinburg is, it's a small resort town in the eastern part of the state of Tennessee that borders on North Carolina. And it's where folks go to get away and vacation. A lot of condos, chalets, and vacation homes there where people get away and go to the mountains. It's a great little tourist area. They got skiing there in the wintertime. And they have not seen anything like this for recent history for at least 100 years. So we've been dealing with some major drought conditions, and our meteorologist could probably talk about that more, but I think they've got 2 people in custody for arson at this point, but it's devastating. They're starting to name or identify the folks that were trapped there. Two of them were from Memphis. One was an architect and his family. But I think this is something that took them quite by surprise. They had a fire, but with the winds that came up the other night, it just ran. It ran crazy. And so it's pretty devastating. Greg is finally got a hold of Greg literally an hour ago, I think. And I've been trying to get a hold of him for several days. And so he sounds pretty wiped out as we all have on these deployments. But he's managing himself or his department. Well, I said, what is Greg? How is Greg Miller? And he kept talking about the fire and the people and his crews. And I said, I know you got that handled, brother. How's Greg Miller? Sometimes we get caught in that vacuum of taking care of others and we don't take care of ourselves. And I hope, Greg, when he listens to this, he knows that we love him. We're thinking about him. And you got to take care of yourself before you take care of other people. So rest periods are very important. Nutrition, hydration, all those things that we do without when we have these events happen in our careers.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, Jim, because we haven't talked about that for a long time. But here's a guy who feels, he's responsible for a lot. And those are the guys that tend to forget about taking care of themselves. But there's still a lot more work to do. In fact, Jamie just posted an update that the death toll is up to 10 and expected to rise as they find more missing folks and they identify them.
Well, we asked Greg, how you doing? He said, well, I'll know in about middle of January, so call me back then. So, I mean, it's going to take a while. So I think today was the day that they didn't look forward to. I think they're using about 20% of their crews on fire suppression and the rest, you know, the rest of their resources on search and rescue right now. So they're starting to find more people. This area is somewhat concentrated, but it's been a very growing area in the last several years. So there's a lot of remote area that hasn't been assessed yet as far as search. So there is. So we Tennessee Task Force One Urban Search and Rescue has their cadaver dogs and search dogs on the scene right now. So they've been searching for the last couple of days.
Yeah. Well, good. That's exactly what I was going to ask, is how many outside resources like you, sir, were you able to get? And I'm glad to hear that. So give Greg our best. Let him know we're thinking about him and we're going to keep an eye on this. And, you know, if he ever wants to chat about it someday when things settle down, we'd love to have him.
Yeah, I think that'd be a great idea. We'll give him a little time to breathe, and I'm sure he'd love to talk about it, because he said, you know, what he did say is this is going to be one for the history books that we haven't seen in a while.
Well, and that's the weird thing about the weather that maybe Kyle can address later, is the weather has been so bizarre in terms of the things that are happening in parts of the country that you don't usually see those things. Because I think about those, you know, having lived in California and been involved in wildfire medical for so many years, as I sit here freezing my butt off in Colorado, it's hard to even imagine that. So thinking about that going on in Tennessee even seems weird to me. It's not something you'd expect. You'd expect it on the West Coast. But
yeah, that's something that I was thinking about as all these fires were going on in, you know, Western North Carolina, Eastern Tennessee, and in that area. It's just, you know, this is not something we see very often on the East Coast. And maybe Kyle is a good time to bring you in, talk a little bit about, you know, how this was 30 or 40 days without rain, extreme drought conditions that were already in existence that just were exacerbated.
Yeah, Jamie and everyone, it was a really, really sad situation down there in Tennessee. I have several friends and colleagues in that area, and watching it unfold from that personal perspective was very heartbreaking. But to kind of talk a little bit more on the weather side of it, I'll table the kind of the bizarre weather around the country question for a little bit later. I think to bridge off for the discussion we just had on the response phase of things, I think it'd be beneficial for everyone to talk a little bit about fire weather and why these fires were able to spread so rapidly. So essentially, fire weather, breaking it down, it essentially has three components in the fire environment. So you have weather, topography, and fuel. So fire weather, we're looking at different things, or as a meteorologist, I'd be looking at things such as the humidity, so like a moisture in the air. I'm looking at wind speed and direction, the temperature, historical precipitation, and, you know, things of that nature. So different variables on the weather side. On the topography side, we're talking about more terrain, so slopes and things like that. And then fuel, we're talking about what is there for the fire to burn. So let's say the ideal fire environment would be warm, dry, and windy weather, abundant, seasoned, or very dry fuel on sloping terrain. And unfortunately, all these components came together there in Tennessee earlier this week. And these components, you know, it's really difficult, especially on a fire scene, to be forecasting these things. And so for fires that are occurring, especially larger fire complexes and things, the National Weather Service will deploy incident meteorologists or folks that are specially trained to focus on these hyper-local conditions, which can change, as those of you that have worked on wildfire scenes know, minute to minute. And of course, throughout the day, as fires can actually create their own weather as well. So that's why I'll just briefly, I'll end this part with saying that I advocate for all folks on a fire scene, or at the very least, command staff having a firm grasp on wildland fire behavior having someone as Overwatch or Outlook, and of course, pay attention to those morning briefings because it's pretty vital information that you're getting there.
Good point. Joe, are 90-mile-an-hour winds common in that area? I mean, that seems really high.
That is very high, and no, they are not common there at all. And Kyle described it beautifully. That was exactly the scenario in Gatlinburg. It is in a deep valley, and the mountainsides are quite sloped. And of course, the cabins and all that Jim described earlier are on very twisty mountain roads and hanging off the sides of steep slopes. And I think a firestorm is a great way to describe what happened there. It sounds like the speed of movement of fire was 50 or 60 mile an hour for the fire front to be moving. And the situation was so dry and ready to go that it sparked it off very quickly. And I think that's what caught most of these people off guard. It just moved so incredibly quickly that they were unable to respond fast enough.
Kyle, do you see the weather conditions changing down there anytime soon? Are they going to get some relief?
Well, they've had a couple bouts of rain go through, and actually it was the weather conditions in advance of the rain they got there on earlier in the week that actually helped to spread and actually get these fires going, because these fires all started as a smaller fire down a very near, perhaps just within the boundaries of Smoky Mountain National Park, down there just south of Gatlinburg. And as a cold front, which brings unsettled weather, generally convective precipitation, so rain, perhaps a little bit of hail and severe weather possibly, as that was moving to the east towards Gatlinburg, out ahead of the cold front, winds are generally from the south. And so those winds from the south help to actually blow the embers from the existing fires north into the Gatlinburg Pigeon Forge area. And that combined with, we talked about the 40 to 70 miles an hour, that's sustained winds. That's not the gusts that were upwards of 80 to 90 miles an hour, as you've already indicated. Once those embers came down, dry leaves and brush from drought conditions were already there in place. And then to top it all off, those high winds, those wind gusts, as they're affected and channeled by the sloping terrain there in that area, that brought down power lines, which then caused more fires. And it was truly a chaotic situation, but managed very well by the folks there on scene.
So, Jamie, I think we may have to start a meteorology glossary as we have these discussions, because it's going to go by
stuff.
So fast.
Yeah, I'm so glad we reached out and connected with Kyle, because I think moving forward, it's going to be important to have a meteorologist as a resource for our show and for our audience moving down the road. We've talked about things like hurricanes and Hurricane Matthew and the response for that. We've talked about all kinds of things and the wildfires on the West Coast and now these on the East Coast. And weather just plays such an important part of so many things.
Yeah, and I want to give, I never gave him an actual proper definition. Besides being a meteorologist, Kyle's a natural hazards and social media educator. He's a ski patroller, which we have in commonality. So he does have medical background. And as well, he's an instructor and evaluator for the National Disaster Preparedness Training Center. So we have a lot in common. He has a lot in common with the folks in this podcast. And we came up with a whole bunch of subjects that we could broach. And I'm sure when we think about it, we can come up with some more. I'm sure Joe and Jim can come up with some more, because there isn't anything we talk about that doesn't involve weather in some respect. Would you agree, Joe?
Oh, that's exactly right.
So,
I wanted to ask Joe and Jim real quick. We talked a little bit about Tennessee Task Force One sending in their search dogs and things like that. In the response for this event, is there anticipation of calling in like federal resources, or is the state of Tennessee have enough resources with their own mutual aid agreements to manage the situation on hand?
So there are several departments right now that have responded regionally from, I'm not sure from other states, but I know for certain from Tennessee, I know we've had some from Middle Tennessee over to east. It's a good 6-7 hour drive from Memphis. So we haven't had many go from there. As far as I know that the governor has been in touch with the president, I don't know if he's asked for federal resources at this point. I believe the dogs are probably sent as a state resource. That's kind of an understanding that we have with having a task force here is that we can deploy pieces of our team as a state resource if requested, and which was. So there's many, you know, facets of emergency management, as you know. So response is one of them. Recovery is another. So there very well may be some federal assistance, of course, right, that will be granted for the recovery piece of this.
And it sounds like this is going to be an effort that's going to take a long time. As you were saying, the chief commented on the fact that he might have all the details maybe by January. So I think that sounds logical. There's a lot of area to cover, and there's a lot of things to discover, I think.
Well, I think you're right. I think there's also probably a significant increase yet to come in the death toll. There are quite a number of people missing. And as I said earlier, some of these areas are really difficult to get into. The roads are very narrow. There's obviously trees down all over them. And, you know, the hillside's burned up. And, of course, the structures are completely gone. And so the ability to locate victims' remains and that sort of stuff is going to be quite challenging in this environment for sure.
Yes, very sad. One more quick question for Kyle on this issue. Kyle, can you give us a real quick, if it's possible, explanation on how fire creates its own weather? I've always been curious about that.
Sure. So fires are a really unique animal, I guess you could say. And one of the ways that they create their own unique weather is by the heat that they give off. So as the fires, as they radiate heat upward into the atmosphere, that's forcing that air, that warm air wants to rise. And as it's rising, the byproducts of, combustion or burning things, two of those main products are carbon dioxide and water vapor. So that water vapor in that, in the smoke and things and the particulates, as those rise in that air cools, it condenses, it forms clouds, perhaps precipitation. And that's one way they can create, say, precipitation. And then now once that precipitation starts to fall, as it falls into drier air, that precipitation evaporates. Evaporation is a cooling process. So now you have cool, dry air then descending, hitting the ground, and now starting to interact on the boundaries of that fire, which can cause it to act very chaotically. If it's not being paid attention to and things like that. So that's just one of the ways it can happen. You can also look at this too. If anyone's ever been to, say, Niagara Falls up there in Canada, at about every hour or so routinely, you'll get a little rain shower that develops from all the moisture that's given off and that water vapor from that waterfall. So very hyperlocal features like that can interact with conditions already there in the larger atmosphere that can cause those local conditions and events that are very, very difficult for meteorologists to predict in advance.
And you just reminded me of another thing, because of course I watch the Weather Channel, and I've heard of there is such a thing as a fire nado, that fire tornadoes can actually occur, correct?
Fire tornadoes, yes. They've gone by many different names, fire nados, all different kinds of things. There's some pretty incredible pictures of them out there. But essentially what's happening there is you have an interaction of, that warm air from that fire rising. And as that air rises, the air as it rises, it has to be replaced by cooler air around it. So as that cooler air comes in, it could start to spin, say, kind of in the horizontal, say like a, you know, like a tire rolling down a road and that kind of horizontal. But then as it interacts with that rising air from that fire, that horizontal rotation tilts upward, and all of a sudden you have a fire tornado.
Fascinating. Jim and Joe, do you have any questions for Kyle?
I'm just kind of scared right now, honestly.
Oh, we're scaring for these poor guys. All of these things. Well, if you watch the Weather Channel, you'll see all kinds of strange things.
Well, now, there's been some, you know, the rain front that came through that helped a little bit with, you know, dampening the fire that came through the last few days. I also brought some tornadoes with it to the Western Georgia and North Carolina and parts, I think, even in Florida. So, I mean, extreme weather. You know, they wanted the rain, but of course that extreme weather also brought with it some other problems. So, you know, it sounds like, Kyle, you guys always have a lot to keep an eye on, and it's got to be, you know, we all make fun of the weatherman getting it wrong, but good grief, with all the variables out there, how can you predict anything?
Oh, goodness. Well, you know, as they say, as the saying goes, you know, you can be wrong 50% of the time as a weather person and still get paid. Some people call that, you know, it's just crazy. I call it job security, but hey, call it what you will. But to your point, though, to your question, with all the different, you know, variables that we talk about with temperature, moisture, you know, and wind speed and direction, and not just at the surface, but all the way up through the top of the atmosphere and how these interact and evolve going forward in time, there's a forecast process that meteorologists follow. So you start essentially with looking at how the weather has evolved up until this point, say in time, as well as what it's doing right now. And then once you have a current handle on what's happening and what has happened up until now, then I begin to look forward, or a meteorologist would look forward in time at computer model predictions. So using multiple computer models and looking not really at specific numbers necessarily right away, but are those models, are they in agreement with each other? Are they showing a similar evolution in the weather? And if they're showing that and they're more in agreement, I would have a higher confidence in my forecast. So then going forward in time, those models spit out some information. I interpret that information as a meteorologist, and then I take that and I apply my local knowledge to that particular area. That's why the National Weather Service has 128 local forecast offices across the United States and our territories, because weather is so local and so dependent on terrain, topography, and local conditions and histories that it really takes that local knowledge to be able to handcraft that forecast for you all in your backyard. And be very cautious with your forecasting. And some people do attribute some of the forecasts they receive on their mobile applications on their mobile device to that of a meteorologist, when in reality, many of those apps that you're getting weather from on your smartphone are actually pure computer model forecasts. There is no human input on those whatsoever. So if those numbers are pretty wildly off from what's happening on a regular basis, consider changing your source, perhaps considering looking at the National Weather Service's forecast, that is weather.gov, as opposed to weather.com.
Oh, good point. Yeah, we're going to have to plug some of that stuff into the website. Well, it's reminding me, Jamie, when you and I were in New Orleans and Joe was actually on his way to deal with Matthew, where Jim was there with us. But I remember looking at all those different models because we were watching that, you know, every chance we get. And they were so all over the map. And the big question, of course, was it going to make landfall and where? So I can appreciate what Kyle's saying, is that nobody could accurately predict, especially with a hurricane, Kyle. I assume that those are the hardest to predict because they can change their mind at any given time, given specific conditions, right?
Well, Sam, with hurricane forecasting, that is a unique and a very honed skill unto itself. And so a lot of respect for the folks at the National Hurricane Center down there in Miami, Florida, who are forecasting these, as well as the hurricane hunters that are flying those missions, observing the conditions in the hurricanes, because truly they are quite difficult to forecast and very difficult for computer models to forecast as well, in part because hurricanes are actually steered by winds in the middle part of our atmosphere, between about, you know, right around, say, 15,000 feet or so. And that's really difficult sometimes if, you know, when we don't have observations from, say, weather balloons and things offshore over the oceans, it's really difficult for those computer models to have an accurate picture of what the atmospheric conditions truly are. And that's why we need to fly those Hurricane Hunter aircraft in and around those tropical systems so that we can put better data in the computer models so they can give us a better prediction. Still not perfect, but if you look back over the years, that cone of uncertainty is slowly, slowly decreasing.
Well, that's a topic in and of itself on all the different tools that you guys use to actually get accurate forecasts. So, Joe and Jim, I know you guys have to go out and play in the cold with the PJs, so we should probably wrap this one.
Let's be clear. We are not going to play in our PJs out in the cold.
Yes, perhaps we should clarify. I'm talking parasuit jumpers, not pajamas, in case you missed the first part of this podcast. But maybe you should, because they'd be a lot warmer out there. So it sounds like you guys at Paragon have been really busy with stuff. Every time we talk to you, you got a bunch of stuff going on. So what's coming up for you?
Well, I think we've got our little outing in the United Kingdom coming up in about 2 weeks. Several more opportunities with special operations over the next several months. Gosh, we'll be all over the country doing some of our work with our CPR and Zoll Medical. So we've got a lot going on.
Excellent.
Well, good for you.
Joe, if people want to bring you guys in to talk about training, I know you guys cover all aspects of disaster planning and training and management topics. Where can they find out more about you?
Well, we're on the web at paragonmedicalgroup.com. You can also find us on Facebook under the same name. Our Twitter feed is ParagonMedEDU. And you can always reach us through the Disaster Podcast.
And we do appreciate all your support that continues to help us bring this podcast to our audience members. And so we urge everybody to head over and check out your site, check out the video there on the front page and find out a little bit more about what you guys do. And thanks again and be safe tonight. Okay.
Thanks so much.
Kyle, where can folks find you? And you found us on Twitter. Is there a place where folks can maybe check out what you're tweeting about?
Absolutely. So I'm on all the social medias, so Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn, and Facebook. Just search for me under WX Kyle Nelson, all one word. So WX is the abbreviation for weather. WX Kyle Nelson. You'll find me out there and follow along. We're coming up on ski season, so check out all the fun pictures from the slopes as well as all my travels and teaching during the summer.
Excellent. And thanks so much for coming on the show. And it's great to have another listener that comes on and contributes. That's part of the community here. And we really appreciate you taking some time to share with the audience.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me. It's truly an honor to be on a podcast that I love and respect so much, and look forward to chatting with you more in future about weather and other things on the response side as well.
Excellent. We'll look forward to it. Sam, where can folks find you?
In the usual social media places, SamBradley11 on Twitter and Sam Bradley on Facebook and all of the places that Kyle mentioned, because I think I'm on all of those as well. You can usually find me. Also, Kyle, we'd love to have you connect to our Facebook site so people can ask you questions directly. And that's easy to find. Just put up Disaster Podcast in Facebook, and you can find our ongoing conversation. And certainly on the disasterpodcast.com website, where we, instead of having to find people on Twitter when they like something, it'd be great if you folks would come up and give us your thoughts and feelings on what we're doing and what you'd like to see us talk about. And where do they find you, Jamie?
Well, you can find me under the handle PodMedic in most social media channels, so just search for me there. And of course, always over at disasterpodcast.com and on our Facebook page, our Facebook, actually it's a Facebook group. And all you have to do to get into the group is just request to join. you know, that just will one of us or several of us that are administrators, and we'll just click and add you right away, and gives you an opportunity to kind of share in the conversation. We have, I don't know, 300-400 people over there now, and it's a great place to see what's going on in the disaster community, as well as what's going on the podcast. So we look forward to that. You know, Sam, just some tragic information that we've talked about tonight, and inspirational as well on the behalf of the responders that have just gone above and beyond in the Gatlinburg area and from surrounding communities to manage this terrible situation.
That's true. We feel badly for all those people, and hopefully we'll keep in touch with since Jim and Joe are in touch with the chief there, we can keep track of what's going on with them and hope for a speedy recovery, although it doesn't sound like that's going to happen. But we'll keep you in our prayers, people, and keep an eye out on what's going on with you.
So, Sam, you know, we can wrap up and just kind of, you know, remind folks that the disasters come in all kinds of shapes and sizes, and the weather is influential in so many of the things we talk about here on the show, but it always comes back to the same things.
It does, and that's another discussion we need to have with Kyle, is how do we get these things in areas where we don't expect them? And I think that's just something we're seeing in the weather today. That could be an interesting discussion. But in the meantime, it makes the point that disaster medicine is not our everyday medicine.